This is Stellacast, episode 8. Well, what's up there, my little chickadees? What's going on? Jacob Byrne here, StellaCulinary.com. In this episode, we're going to tackle some gravy topics that we have over on the Stella Culinary Forum. So if you'd like to follow around, if you'd like to follow along with our discussion on gravies, you can head on over to this episode's show notes, which you can find at StellaCulinary.com/Scast. StellaCulinary.com/StellaCast8. So StellaCulinary.com/StellaCast8. And I'll have a link to everything that I reference in this audio episode of the Stellacast. Oh, my computer is going crazy on me. That's why I'm saying the same thing over and over again and trying to buy some time. Give me one second here. Oh, I know. Just total professionalism at all times when broadcasting. You know, when it's a one-man show, you don't have your... you know, I fired my my lead producer for the podcast. I was paying him 100 G's a year. He wanted 150. I said, you know what? Go screw off. You're not worth that much. Just kidding. I wish I had $5 to pay a podcast producer. But no, it's just me here dicking around with my computer, trying to get these episodes out to you. But what I can do pretty well, you know, since I... I'm a miserable failure at podcasting. What I can do is I can help you figure out some of the issues you have going on with your food. That's something I've been doing for quite some time now. That's what I do for a living. I cook and I teach. I teach cooking and I cook some more. So this topic that we have, gravy, the forum topic is actually called sauce, suave, smooth texture with a glossy appearance. And it was started by Man Bear Pig, half man, half bear, half pig. And he's having some issues, along with some other forum members, with his gravy. So I'm just going to go through and kind of knock these questions down, knock these statements down, see what we can figure out about gravy and the gravy-making process. And then as we, I mean, it's summer right now at the time of recording this, but we'll kind of make this our default gravy discussion. And then as we get closer to Thanksgiving, at least Thanksgiving in the United States, which comes late November, we'll talk more about gravy. And because that's really when you see all the questions pop up about gravy. So maybe I'll do a like a Q&A style podcast where I just let people submit all their questions about gravy. And you know, after this, they listen to this one and we'll knock them down. So that way you have a good game plan for attack. Because really, like, mashed potatoes are fairly easy, especially if you follow our the recipe that I have a video recipe on StellaCulinary.com, and I'll go ahead and link to that since I mentioned it in this episode's show notes. But if you can, you know, make mashed potatoes, which are pretty easy, and you can roast turkey somewhat decently, which that's a whole other podcast, and then make a good gravy, like, you pretty much mastered the art of Thanksgiving. Because everything else, all the other side dishes are fairly easy and fairly simple to execute. I mean, you throw out some clam dip, you throw out some green bean casserole. I mean, it's not exactly rocket science. But the biggest stumbling blocks are, number one, a dry-ass turkey, which sucks, you know. And a lot of people have a hard time getting that one right. So we should probably do a separate turkey podcast. And then the gravy. And the gravy is important because most people's turkeys are dry. So if you have shitty gravy with dry turkey, I mean, you're having a pretty bummer Thanksgiving. But that doesn't mean that gravy can only be used at Thanksgiving or during the holidays. I mean, gravy can be used year-round. Sometimes it gets a little bit heavy for the summer. But I'll tell you what, I went down to Marty's Cafe here in Truckee the other day. And against my better judgment, because I've been trying to drop a few pounds, you know, maintain my girlish figure, especially now that I started doing martial arts again. And I've just, it's, man, it's, you know, during the sparring sessions, I'm good for about 45 seconds, and then I'm toast. But, you know, I've been eating pretty healthy, and I figured, what the hell, I'm going to have some biscuits and gravy, because Marty is one of the few guys in town, one of the few guys that who have a restaurant, quite frankly, that can do a proper biscuits and gravy, because his gravy, his white sausage gravy, is very light and really flavorful. And then he has these homemade biscuits that are great. So he does a good job with his gravy because he's following a proper technical approach. So even though it is July, you just see the other day, I had some gravy for breakfast on some fresh baked biscuits, and it was delicious. So yes, you can make gravy year round for sure. And it's a good technique to know and understand. So Man Bear Pig starts off by saying, I'd like to keep this to starch-thickened sauces, ranging from the French mother sauces to their offshoots, the U.S. interpretations. I live quite a frugal life, but I've always spent good money in restaurants. I've always felt it's worth the money. I've had some amazing experiences and thrown money down the drain, too. I don't mind taking a risk on what may be a bad restaurant. It just makes me further appreciate the good ones. I've always found that sauces in great restaurants share the same characteristics. They're suave, smooth, moist, light, and have a glossy appearance. Taste is subjective, but I think the above consistency, texture, and appearance is universally accepted as wonderful. Wunderbar. Wonderful. That's my aim. What about you? Yeah. And I mean, just to kind of side note, it's generally sauces that will set a restaurant apart, especially when you're talking about going from good to great. It's their attention to the sauces and their technical approach to sauce making that will set them apart. You know, it's really not that hard to make a biscuit. It's really not that hard to pan roast a filet of beef to mid-rare or to grill a New York strip steak to mid-rare. What takes that to the next level and makes people want to pay money for it time and time and time again is the sauce that accompanies that main ingredient on the plate, that enhances that main ingredient. And so if you can tackle sauce making and understand it, then you're instantly going to take your game to the next level. So I have a resource that you can find at stellaculinary.com/sauces. And that resource is there to kind of give you a crash course in sauce making from a technical approach. The main piece of content that pulls that all together is my lecture video on the three modern mother sauces, which is a technique-based approach to sauce making. And in contrast to the five French mother sauces, which are important to understand but can become redundant at times. Now, what Man Bear Pig is describing, that suave, smooth, glossy sauce, it falls under, in when you're talking about the three modern mother sauces, my codification of sauce making, it falls under the reduction sauce process. Now, stepping back and viewing through the lens of the five French mother sauces, which we have five podcast episodes, one for each mother sauce, in our Stella Culinary School podcast series, which you can find online at stellaculinary.com/SCS. And we talk about the five French mother sauces and the three that are typically, the three that are always thickened by roux are bechamel, which are milk-based, velouté, which is white stock-based, and sauce brune or espagnol or brown sauce, which is a brown stock base. So brown stock thickened with brown roux equals brown sauce or espagnol. White stock thickened with white roux equals velouté. Bechamel thickened with white roux milk thickened with white roux equals bechamel. And then the secondary ingredients are added to these sauces to make what you call small sauces or secondary sauces. You know, so your cream sauces, anything, you know, your demi-glosses. Now, in classic French cuisine, specifically the brown sauce was a long process. And the brown sauce would go So for Espanol, you would do brown stock thickened with brown roux. And then you would combine that with equal amounts of more brown stock. And then you would reduce by half. Now, this is very commonly overlooked in sauce making, especially when using a roux-thickened sauce, because roux-thickened sauces nowadays, especially in the United States, because they don't have the classic heritage of French cuisine, roux-thickened sauces are either treated as gravies or as shortcuts. But in France, a roux-thickened sauce was not a shortcut. It was a long, drawn-out process. And so the reason why you use a roux in the first place, which is butter combined with flour, or quite frankly, fat combined with flour, but technically the fat is butter, and you cook it. And what happens during this cooking process is the raw taste of the flour gets cooked out, and the fat will evenly coat all the starch granules of the flour. So if you just take the flour and drop it into your pot of stock that you want to thicken into a sauce, then you're going to get clumps because the starches on the outside of that flour gelate, and they create clumps in your gravy. That's how you get clumpy gravy. So you cook the flour with the fat, and you cook it to various stages. So sometimes you just cook it just long enough to combine before the flour turns any color, and that's a white roux. Sometimes you cook it to a little bit of a yellow color, or like a very, very light golden brown, and that's called a yellow roux. And then you have your brown roux, which is used for the espagnole, where the butter and the flour is cooked together over long periods of time, over slow heat, so it browns evenly, and you get a brown roux. And the cooking of the flour will also add a flavor to your sauce, where you have that toasted, roasted, nutty aroma that comes from a brown roux. And for me, when I'm making a brown gravy, it just doesn't taste like gravy unless I have that toasted flour taste, those nutty aromas that come from that rich, dark brown roux. Now, in Creole cuisine, they normally, a lot of times, so they'll use what's called a black roux, which is a very, very dark roux that they cook very slowly. But some of the trickier Creole chefs, they'll actually use various types of roux. Come on in, boys. Sit down. I'm talking roux and gravies.
Talking what?
Talking roux and gravies.
Oh, ruined gravies.
Well, you can ruin a gravy with a bad-made roux. Waka waka. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
Hello, Ben. So what the Creole chefs will do, besides using the black roux, which is cooked quite a long time over very low heat, is they'll use multiple roux. They'll use a brown roux, they'll use a light roux, and then a black roux for both color and flavor, because each stage of cooking that roux is going to result in a different complexity of flavor. So, Man Bear Pig, what you're looking for is either a very low and slow cooked sauce. Because what happens is when you add roux, now I'm looking also too at, let's actually go ahead and read Man Bear Pig's technical approach. So he says, I make a gravy after a roast. It's a last minute sauce. Yeah, so that's actually where gravy emerged from. So in classic French cuisine, what would happen is they would cook these sauces for a very long period of time, like the brown sauce. So the brown sauce or the espagnole could be cooked for 10 hours. And what they do is they add the roux in and they slowly simmer that stock and reduce it over time, and they add more liquid as they go, as it starts to evaporate. And so what happens is the protein, the gluten in the flour will coagulate over time, and it will rise to the surface as scum that you skim. So as you skim those proteins, then you're left with a purer starch in your sauce, which gives you that glossy appearance. But when you do a roux thickened sauce, that takes quite a bit of time. It takes a lot of simmering. So that's why when you add like a pure starch, like cornstarch, arrowroot, potato starch to a sauce, it has an immediate glossy appearance because there is no protein in it to be thrown off as scum. So for a roux to actually work and to give you that glossy flavor, that glossy appearance, you need to do a slow simmering process. Now, what's common in the United States is what you describe, and not just the United States, but in European cuisine. And that's what differentiates sauce brown or Espanol sauce from a gravy, is the slow cooking process. So you say, I make the gravy after a roast. It's a last-minute sauce. The texture is coarse and color is matte. Yeah, and the color is matte because, again, you have the proteins, the gluten in the flour that is refracting light. So instead of having that clear or glossy, shiny texture or a consistency, it's refracting that light and making it a flat, matte look. Now you say, I desire the above method, texture, and consistency. I cannot simmer it long enough to remove the starch structure and provide the above consistency.
Get some Wondra.
Yep. There we go.
Yeah, get okay. some Wondra.
Wondra is amazing.
Yeah, so Wondra is gelatinized. It's gelled starch. So what they do is they combine, to my knowledge, so it's I know that it's a pre-gelled starch, it's pre-gelled flour, but what they do, I believe their process is they combine the flour with water so they can fully gel the starch in the flour, and then they dehydrate it and grind it into a very fine powder, and then it comes in a shaker can and you shake it into your sauce. And that's...
It's just like a roux that absorbs instantly.
Except it's cheating.
Kind of.
It is.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't add the flavor of a roux.
No.
No, it's just purely a thickener.
So, if you're doing a roux thickened sauce, it's not a last, quote unquote, last minute sauce, no matter what.
So why would you use Wondra over a pure starch like potato starch or cornstarch?
I don't like the snotty texture of like a cornstarch slurry.
Yeah, fair enough.
I just really don't like that texture. I avoid it whenever possible.
And that's a good point. It is texturally different. Potato starch, I think you have less of an issue with that. But cornstarch, yeah, it does definitely have, especially if it's heavily thickened by a starch. But he also makes a culinary sin. Let me see if I can find it here. So, yeah, I mean, the whole purpose, normally speaking, so you have a roast. So you have like your turkey, you have your prime rib that you're roasting. Then you take it out, you let it rest, and you have your fat in the bottom of the pan with the brown little nummy bits, which is called your fond. You take that fat out of the pan, reserve that fat, and then deglaze those brown bits. And usually that is just, you know, that those the brown bits and your deglazing liquid is your flavor base. Now, if you have some stock on hand, then you can use some added stock. Then you pour off that deglazing liquid. You add your cooking fat, or the fat that was rendered during the cooking process, back into your roasting pan, and you add equal amounts of flour. Now, you cook that to whatever stage you want, light brown, dark brown. With a roast, I'm usually going dark brown. And then you add your deglazing liquid back in, and you, which will then thicken into your gravy. Now, because it's a last-minute sauce, and that's by nature what a gravy is, then you're never going to have that smooth, shiny consistency of the restaurant-style sauce that you described in your original post. But also, too, what Man Bear Pig does is he combines the flour with his cold deglazing liquid and then heats it up. So what you're doing there is you're making what's called a whitewash, which is one of the worst thickening agents out there, which, you know, whitewash is just, you know, stirring water with flour. And it's bad because you're not enhancing the flavor of your gravy at all. In fact, you're taking away from the flavor of your gravy. So you're going to want to use a roux for sure, and you can cook that roux ahead of time. But the normal process for making a gravy is to dump off the fat, deglaze, use that deglazing liquid as your flavor base, and then thicken that with the roux that's created with your fat and your flour. Does that make sense, Alex?
Yeah, that's
yeah, that's
pretty standard.
Yeah, so what you want as far as the glossy consistency sauce is what we use in our restaurant, what a lot of high-end restaurants use, which is a full reduction sauce. So what you're going to need for that is you're going to need a good stock, and a stock that's reinforced and reduced. So a lot of times we'll use veal stock or a roasted veal stock. But at home, and I make pan reduction sauces quite a bit at home because they're really quick and easy once you have a stock on hand. What I do is I cook a lot of meat on the bone, so pork chops, a lot of whole chickens, chicken thighs, chicken legs, whatever. And I'll save the bones, and I'll just pop them in a Ziploc bag in my freezer and just kind of let them hang out until they build up. And then I'll make a stock with that. And then I just continually use that same stock to make a new stock. And I reduce that stock to at least half. And then you can take that resulting stock and then freeze it. So in the sense of your roast, what I would then do is I would pour off the excess fat and the braising liquid, or not braising liquid, the resulting liquid. And a lot of times I'll incorporate that fat back in by a reinforcement step of roasting mirepoix and other aromatics in that cooking fat in a pan. And then you deglaze that fond with your wine, beer, juice, water, whatever, reduce that down. Then you add your reinforced and reduced stock, which is then going to reduce into a consistency that coats the back of a spoon. And when that happens, when that consistency can coat the back of a spoon, then you're going to have a beautiful reduction sauce that's full of flavor, and that is a true shiny, glossy glaze, which you're never going to achieve with a roux-thickened sauce and a roux-thickened gravy, especially if you're not willing to spend 10 hours to simmer out all the impurities that the flour brings to the table.
Yeah, if you're going to spend 10 hours doing the whole roux thing, you might as well make stock and then reduce it, and it'll be just a far better product.
Exactly. I mean, the only time that we use a roux in our kitchen is when we're specifically trying to make gravy, and that's usually reserved for family meal. Because gravy doesn't taste the same.
Soup sometimes. Clam chowder.
Again, for family meal. I don't think we've ever served a
roux.
I don't think we've ever served a roux thickened sauce or soup in this restaurant.
I don't think so either. Not to my knowledge.
We tried doing the Espanol thing with that squab sauce that one time, but we forewent that in favor of just full reduction.
Yeah, that was different though, because so we did do this squab sauce that kind of got lost in translation. For ease of execution, we ended up just turning into a full reduction. But my approach for that squab sauce, which I still really like, is what's called farinier. And farinier is just flour in French. But in the context of a thickening technique, you're actually dusting the product with flour and then browning it. And that acts as a makeshift roux, because the surface area of the flour is very, very thin, and it's being cooked in the fat that you're using to sear the meat. So you'll see this a lot of times in like classic short rib recipes, or other stew or braising recipes, where the flour is coats the meat during the searing process, and then that little bit of flour will help to gently thicken the sauce later. And if done right, it actually adds a nice complexity. It adds that toasty, nutty aroma that brown flour can add to a sauce or a braising liquid. So we would take the squab bodies and we would toast them, or we would dredge them in flour, then toast them in a good amount of butter, basically fry them in butter. And then build our sauce based on that. But it could get tricky at some points if you're not constantly watching it. So for us, it was just easier to maintain consistency to roast those squab bones and then throw a reduced chicken stock over the squab bones and then add in the aromatics that we wanted for that specific sauce, which was cinnamon, cloves, fresh vanilla bean, and then reduce it down. And as it reduced, we skimmed any fat that came to the top, any scum that came to the top, and we had a beautiful glossy reduction sauce that we didn't have to simmer for 5-6 hours or all day long basically during our prep to throw off all the scum from the flour that thickened the sauce.
for light thickening, I think I use at home. I use a filet, like gumbo filet, and that will actually it doesn't work very well, but it is like a starchy thickener, and it has a nice flavor too. It's almost like subtle licorice-y.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never used that for thickening before.
It's very light thickening.
Hmm.
But that's why, like in gumbo or jambalaya, you'll use for a gumbo, you'll use black roux and a brown roux, and then a ton of filet. I don't even know what that shit's made from. I think it's a root.
Let's find out. It's gumbo file, right?
Filet. There's an accent mark.
Yeah,
over
there is. Filet powder. Let's see. Yeah, you got to make a... So filet powder, also called gumbo filet or gumbo file, if you know, you like to ignore
an accent
emphasis.
Mark.
is a spicy herb made from dried and ground leaves of the North African sassafras tree.
That's why it's licorice-y.
Okay. File powder or filet powder is used in Louisiana Creole cuisine in the making of some types of gumbo, a thick Creole super stew often served over rice. Several different varieties exist. I'm not really seeing any starch in here, though.
I guess maybe it isn't starch, but it does thicken a little bit.
Maybe just by particulate matter.
Yeah.
Sprinkled sparingly over gumbo as a seasoning and a thickening agent. Oh, okay. Wait. Filet can provide thickening when okra is not in season, and types of gumbo that use okra or roux as a thickener for gumbo instead of filet. Sprinkled sparingly over gumbo as a seasoning and a thickening agent, filet powder adds a distinctive earthy flavor and texture. Filet powder is made by harvesting the young leaves and stems of sassafras plant and grinding them. Filet powder is generally not added until the vegetable and meat are super finished cooking and removed from the heat or sauce ordered. Okay, yeah, so like you said, it's a very slight thickening agent.
Yeah.
But, so that's another thing that you can stick up your sleeve. But really, I mean, because Man Bear Pig's initial approach or initial comment was that he wants to do the replicate the glossy, smooth restaurant style sauces, and the way that you're going to do that is by following our reduction method. And the thing is, we have a lot of information in my lecture video, the three modern mother sauces. I spend most of that video talking about reductions, because reductions are the ultimate sauce for used in professional kitchens. There's some really fine techniques behind the full reduction. So I'm going to link to that in the show notes. And then further on down, Man Bear Pig is asking about gelation temperatures and, like, you know, when the actual flour will gelate. But that's kind of a mute point, and here's why. Is because the flour gelation temperature will range from about 140 to 185 degrees Fahrenheit, or 55 degrees Celsius to 85 degrees Celsius. And it all depends upon how much fat is in your sauce, the acidity, the alkalinity, all that stuff. So, but the reason why I say it's a mute point is because when you're using flour in a sauce, you're going to bring that up past any gelation temperature anyways, because you need to simmer that flour simmer that sauce to throw that scum off of that flour. So normally what they'll tell you in, you know, culinary schools, or just, you know, when making gravies in general, is when you add your roux, you want to bring your sauce back up to the simmering point, at which point you know that your sauce is fully thickened. Now also too, like you mentioned in your post, obviously as that sauce cools, it's going to become thicker. So you need to understand that when you put that sauce on a plate, it's also going to become thicker. So you need to test your sauce, especially if you're new to sauce making and you just can't judge visually how much it's going to thicken when it starts to cool off. You need to take your sauce and drizzle a spoonful over the plate and let it sit at room temperature for a few minutes and see what the texture, you know, changes to. And then you need to thicken your sauce or thin your sauce based upon that setting texture. So you can't make a gravy that's super thick when it's boiling hot and then expect it to not turn into basically like a slimy bread when it hits your mashed potatoes. It's just not going to happen. So you need to keep that in mind. So you need to So when I thicken with a root, I always under-thicken, always under-thicken. And then I finish my thickening by reduction because that gives me a time to simmer the root in the sauce and do some skimming. The longer you can simmer, the better. Then I'll always strain my sauce to make sure that I, you know, strain it through a chinois to make sure it has a fine consistency and texture. And then I'll, if I'm second guessing myself, which I don't really do anymore because I've made plenty of gravies, but if in the beginning when I would second guess myself, I would always drizzle some sauce on a plate and then just let it set at room temperature for a little bit to see how thick it's going to be. So, anything to add?
True words have never been spoken.
Yeah, and for restaurant service or just serve, so even at your home, like for Thanksgiving, you can hold your gravy in either a bain-marie, which is just a double boiler on the stovetop, and that'll keep it nice and warm. Or, you know, I'm not a big fan of cooking in crock pots in general because I think they're a blunt tool for something that's, you know, it's hard to control a crock pot. They give you like a low and a high setting. But crock pots are awesome for like for holding sauces, soups, and mashed potatoes for a get-together. So I have a couple of crock pots at home just for the holidays. I'll put my mashed potatoes in a crock pot. I'll put my gravy in a crock pot, and it'll hold there happy as hell for 2 hours. And people can just come up and get some piping hot mashed potatoes, spoon some gravy over the top, and everyone's happy, and I don't have to worry about, you know, holding it on a...
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
You didn't... That didn't occur to you?
It's pretty obvious, but I've never actually done that.
Oh, yeah, just put it on low. It'll, you know, just hold anything for a long time.
They actually... I forget the manufacturer, but it was pretty... I saw it at... Walmart, it was like last season, but they started to embrace the fact that people were using these as like party things, like to hold food, and they have like a three of them that link together, and I almost bought it because I'm like, oh, because they were small, they weren't like the big crock pots that you can fit a couple of lamb shanks in. Yeah, so there's like three small crock pots that held together and be perfect for like beans, rice, sauce, you know, like whatever it is that you're doing.
Yeah, like Super Bowl party, you know.
Alex's nacho cheese sauce.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Nacho cheese sauce in one, beans in the other, maybe some pulled pork in a third.
There you go.
I mean, yeah, it's endless. So for the home, crock pots are a great way to hold sauces hot or anything that you're not really worried about overcooking hot. So like mashed potatoes, I'm not really worried about overcooking those. So you can hold them nice and hot. So...
Check out the stock photo on the back of this thing.
I didn't turn it over.
Yeah. I'll take a picture of that and like add it to this post. The Cooler King. Yeah, we had this sales guy come in. We'll check it out because he's giving us a free voila trial. Yeah.
If it works, it's going to be really cool.
Yeah, it'd be good for charcuterie.
Yeah, well, not necessarily.
No?
No, because
we have a pretty, like, you know, in my opinion, pretty high humidity walk-in. So wouldn't that kind of keep, it at a better level?
It might make it too dry, though.
I gotcha. Okay.
Because for charcuterie, in the early stages, you want about a 80% humidity. Because if the exterior dries out, so especially when you're doing, like, sausages, if the exterior dries out too quickly, then the interior moisture won't be able to migrate and escape from the exterior. So normally what you would do is you would start at about 80% humidity and then dial it down over the course of the curing process.
Got it.
Down to like 70, 65. But still, I mean, the air is so dry up here. Even though, I mean, you guys think our walk-in is humid, but it really isn't. I've been into much more humid walk-ins.
No,
you know?
I agree.
The air in Tahoe is so, so dry. But also, too, when you open the walk-in door and you have the cold air mixed with the hot air, you almost have a microclimate that forms. What we're talking about is this guy who came by, this sales dude for Cooler King, and it's basically filters that reduce odor in your walk-in, which we really don't have issues with, and then supposedly by making the environment more dry, he's like, well, you can keep your like salad crisp longer and stuff like that. I'm like, bro, we're not trying to keep iceberg lettuce crisp for like 10 days. Like that's not exactly the restaurant that we are. So
a piece of arugula is gone in a day and a half, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I told him. I'm like, look, we order, you know, in-season ingredients specifically for a purpose, and then we use them and we're done. So we don't have a whole lot of, you know, stuff that we're worried about going bad, especially with like the pop-up style dinners where we make a menu and then we just bounce from it, you know?
Yeah, he tried his best.
Well, I told him, I mean, he's, if you want to sell me something, you give me a free trial. And that's what he did. He gave us, you know, he's going to give us 6 weeks. So he just installed these guys. And we'll see if it makes a difference. But for me, I mean, I've never, I mean, I don't come in to work and I'm just like, man, I wish our walk-in wasn't so stinky and filled with all the shitty lettuce. No, like.
It's very true. We have probably the cleanest walk-in I've ever worked in 15 years.
Yeah, it's funny. He told me, he's like, he looked around, he's like, oh yeah, well, you guys got a pretty new walk-in, so you don't have the same issues as normal. Like, I'm like, no, this walk-in's probably older than me. I mean, I think we're like the third owners of it. Just,
we but, just keep it clean.
Yeah, we happen to believe in scrubbing stuff. Unlike most restaurants. So, all right. Any other tips on gravy?
When we were talking about using dark roux, black roux, brown roux, I think not only like if you want a glossy appearance, whatever, using cooking it out, it should be made hours in advance because I think sometimes the toasted flavor is too strong and it definitely mellows out over time.
For sure, and I think that's I think that can be said for almost any sauce or soup true. Out there.
Oh yeah,
you know, just the.
But I mean, just especially for dark and black roux, like it just tastes like toasted flour for a while until everything like gets to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then it's just nice and nutty after it's kind of mellowed out.
Yeah, I mean that's why sauces always taste better the next day, or soups always taste better the next day, or just. Or when you just take time to do slow, long. And I think a lot of it has to do with actual just diffusion. You know, as you add ingredients to your soup or to your sauce, you know, you have, you know, all the ingredients are separate. Like, it's just like how it takes time for a brine, for the salt in a brine to diffuse into a protein. It takes time for, like, the aromatic molecules of rosemary or thyme to diffuse its way throughout a sauce, or the aromatic molecules of black roux to diffuse its way throughout a gumbo. You know, so you can't just expect to make a pho broth in you know, an hour. You know?
Also true with sauces and guacamole. Takes always better the next day. Yep. Just because all those flavors kind of come together and meld.
Faux schniz. Okay, cool.
Don't say that.
All right. Well, cool. I hope you guys learned some stuff about gravy. And like I said, as we get closer to November, when the gravy questions really start popping up, we'll do a little gravy Q&A. And that's it for this episode of StellaCast. Find us online at stellaculinary.com/StellaCast. We'll drop you into our whole podcast index page. You can follow me online at Chef Jacob. Or better yet, hey, if you want to hang out and connect, just go on over to the Stella Culinary Forums. That's where I'm hanging. You know, I mean, you can shoot me a tweet and all that good stuff, but, I mean, Twitter kind of... We can't have a conversation on Twitter. Go to the forum. There all the time. I hang out. Sign up for our email newsletter so I can send you some spam. And I'll see you guys in the next episode.